we got to deal with it, or whether it's just people who feel like they're fed up. You know, how it happens, what the results are, that I can't predict, but I'm absolutely sure that there are stress points, that there are people who feel like they're being marginalized, they're not being listened to somewhere right now, and they are going to want recourse. We need to make sure that that recourse is positive, it's real engagement, because otherwise, you know, when you take away people's voices, when you take away their ability to be heard, they will make themselves heard in any way that they feel is appropriate.
Lee, you were just saying earlier how much of an activist Ridley is. What did you make of his comments there in that radio interview?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important. You know, historically, he's done these, you know, he's had these moments where people have been very critical of what he's done. People change. And I think he would probably say that he's not the same filmmaker or maybe even person that he was when he did these other projects. And fair play to him. You know, if we're discussing this particular film, I think it's a really balanced, restrained, empathetic portrait that really tries to get to the, you know, the hub of a wide range of issues. So, you know, I can only kind of agree with everything he's saying. And it's also, I think the other thing is, we hear so much about this one time in LA. I would love to hear similar projects about other cities in the US and also in other countries. It's not just America that has systemic, you know, issues with its police force and racism and stuff. It's happening all over the world. And it would be great if there were, you know, similar projects as detailed and nuanced that covered other areas. I know more about, you know, Rodney King and Natasha Harlins than I do about some of the, you know, the issues that have happened in this country simply because of the proliferation of documentaries and studies about this time. Mm-hmm. It's all important, mm-hmm. but I'd also like to see other areas and other countries covered in a similar way.
That's interesting. Of course, this year marks 25 years since the LA riots. Perhaps this is why the emergence of these documentaries are coming out. But Suresh, I'd like to ask you, actually, what are some of the differences or similarities between the US and the UK when it comes to institutional police racism and how they treat black people?
Let's look at the similarities. I think the British police has been found to be institutional racism because of the McPherson inquiry in 1999. And there hasn't been enough work done by the police to show that they've actually dealt with it properly. You've seen in this country, just like America, although the proportion of killings in America is much, much, much greater. You have something like 16 deaths a day. Mm-hmm. You don't have the same frequency, but it's a smaller black population than America. The American population has been there longer. I think what you really have in similarity is the lack of accountability of the police force, the manner in which police always, almost get away with murder or police brutality. Nobody's actually held account in a public arena.
Of course, this is why what caused the riots, effectively the straw that broke the camel's back, was that there was videotape evidence of Rodney King's brutal bleeding, the police officers walked free.
They walked free in Rodney King's case as far as the district was concerned, but obviously, as you know, two people were convicted in the federal court in the subsequent trial. And there are important points to make on the judiciary as well in this trial.
The whole criminal justice system.
The differences are that just the black American political process of being there for a long time, of developing resistance, black power politics, is much more deep-seated than in this country. But this country has this glass ceiling which does not see pivotal figures in the black community just as important as the Americans would do in terms of black. For example, people like Huey Newton in the Black Power Movement. There are equivalents in this country. And just like this film, there's a film called Hard Stop on Tottenham Riots, mm-hmm. which is a fascinating, moving film mm-hmm. of the killing of Duggan told through the eyes of his two friends. It's a fascinating film. It could be much better if it was given more finances. Mm-hmm. So there are attempts being made. But I think this country neglects and actually does not acknowledge the skills that black communities have in their communities, young people, mm-hmm. women and children.
So there's much work to be done, I suppose. And unfortunately, we're reaching the end of the program now. And Lee, just the final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
I would. I think, I mean, I've seen quite a number of the recent films that either touch on this specific area or, you know, institutional racism. And I would say it's one of the more thorough and nuanced films. I would also recommend the OJ Made in America film, which again covers similar things. But it really is, when people actually, it's proper journalism, and it's also good filmmaking. And when you put those together, you know, you really do allow viewers to get a better understanding, and then hopefully that's what you can build on to sort of, you know, change things in the future.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming on to Doc Review. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambayati.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. More than 1.1 million Medicare patients in the United States of America could die over the next decade because they cannot afford to pay for their prescription medications, according to a new study released recently by the West Health Policy Center, a nonprofit and nonpartisan policy research group. If current drug pricing trends continue, researchers estimate cost-related non-adherence to drug therapy will result in the premature death of 112,000 beneficiaries a year, making it a leading cause of death in the U.S., ahead of diabetes, influenza, pneumonia, and kidney disease. Millions more will suffer worsening health conditions and run-up medical expenses that will cost Medicare an additional $177.4 billion by 2030, or $18 billion a year for the next 10 years. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stansil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, High Drug Prices in U.S. Could Result in Premature Deaths of More Than 1.1 Million Seniors in Next Decade, analysis says. Here's the details of this article. More than 1.1 million American seniors in the Medicare program could die prematurely over the next decade because they cannot afford the exorbitant prices of prescription medications. That's according to a study released last week by the West Health Policy Center, a nonprofit and nonpartisan policy research group, and Z. Sanda, the research arm of AmerisourceBergen, a drug distributor. Researchers expect cost-related non-adherence to drug therapy to increase not only unnecessary suffering but also Medicare spending, as deteriorating health conditions drive up preventable expenses by more than $177 billion by 2030. Unless drug prices are reduced, the analysis estimated that 112,000 seniors per year could succumb to early death as a result of not being able to afford their medications. In addition, researchers projected that health complications stemming from the unaffordable cost of prescriptions will force Medicare to spend nearly $18 billion annually on avoidable medical expenses. Prescription drug prices have been soaring, with list prices having increased by 159% from 2007 to 2018. West Health noted that if these trends continue, cost-related non-adherence to drug therapy will be a leading cause of death in the U.S., ahead of diabetes, influenza, pneumonia, and kidney disease. One of the biggest contributors to poor health, hospital admissions, higher healthcare costs, and preventable death is patients failing to take their medications as prescribed, said Timothy Lash, president of the West Health Policy Center. He added, cost-related non-adherence is a significant and growing issue that is a direct result of runaway drug prices and a failure to implement policies and regulations that make drugs more affordable. Currently, Medicare beneficiaries are required to pay 25% of the list price cost of generic and brand name medications until they reach their out-of-pocket maximum. As drug companies continue to raise list prices, the analysis explained, patients may experience a significant increase in their coinsurance cost. If Medicare were able to directly negotiate with pharmaceutical companies, as described in H.R. 3, the Elijah Cummings Lower Drug Cost Now Act, which has languished on the desk of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell since it was passed by House Democrats in December 2019, it would result in dramatically lower prescription drug prices nationwide. HR3 is backed by the Patients for Affordable Drugs Now Coalition. David Mitchell, a cancer patient and the founder of the group, said last year that the legislative proposal could help fix broken system of U.S. and ensure Americans with private and public insurance get the drugs they need at lower prices. According to the Council for Informed Drug Spending Analysis, that is CIDSA, allowing Medicare to negotiate and limit drug price increases could prevent nearly 94,000 deaths per year while also reducing Medicare spending by almost $476 billion by 2030. Sean Dixon, Director of Health Policy at West Health Policy Center and Chair of CIDSA, said that the costs of doing nothing about high drug prices are too high, especially when policy changes such as allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices would result in saving millions of lives and billions of dollars, he added. The price of prescription medications has skyrocketed in recent years in the United States of America. Between 2007 and 2018, list prices for branded pharmaceutical products increased by 159%, and there are few signs of it slowing. According to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, that is CMS, spending on prescription drugs will grow faster than any other major medical good or service over the next several years in the United States of America.
popular debate.
Protests have erupted in France over a new law that has proven controversial. It's over a new security law. The proposed legislation would criminalize the dissemination of images of police officers unless their faces are blurred. Those found guilty would be imprisoned or receive fines. Activists have denounced the law as a violation of press freedom. In this debate, we'll ask whether this is the case and whether France is downgrading its definition of freedom.
On Tuesday, the lower house of the French Parliament gave its green light to the global security bill with an overwhelming majority. The law needs to be approved at the Senate and the French Constitutional Court before it can be enacted. It would legalize sharing images of police officers with malicious purposes. It would also require the faces of law enforcement forces be blurred upon publication. However, it grants further freedom to police to record ordinary citizens without their consent. Anyone found guilty of infringement could face a fine of up to €45,000 and 12 months in jail. Supporters of the bill say it protects officers and their families and that it does not undermine freedom. However, those claims have failed to convince others, as the legislation has faced a barrage of condemnations and outrage from a wide range of people and organizations. Opponents say the legislation erodes freedom of press. On Wednesday, clashes broke out between security forces and demonstrators protesting the bill in the city of Bordeaux. Thousands of people also rallied across the country, including the capital, Paris, against the proposed legislation.
We will no longer be able to film policemen in action and to put them on the social networks, which is, of course, very dangerous because nowadays there is a real issue in France about violence from the policemen.
Amnesty International has lashed out at Paris for persisting with the bill, saying it sends a worrying message. The European Union has also expressed concern, saying Paris needs to ensure that journalists be able to work freely and in full security. The bloc has warned that it will examine the law to make sure it's in line with EU policies. In today's digital world, it's hard to imagine what would happen if people were stripped of the right to film potential injustices. In May, the publication of a video showing US police brutality against a black man sparked weeks of protests. The officer who killed the unarmed man was charged with second-degree murder and later discharged. Such a brutal incident may have gone unheard if it weren't for a passerby to record it on his mobile phone. The new French law takes away from people their minimal protection against police brutality, their freedom to film violence.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, political analyst and member of the Solidarity and Progress Party, Sébastien Perrimoni, joins us from Paris. We also have journalist and political analyst, Geoffroy Coleman, who also joins us from Paris. Gentlemen, welcome. Let me first start with you, if I may, Sébastien Perrimoni. Tell us why you think this case is deemed controversial and, as it has been described, a violation of press freedom.
Yes, it's not only the violation of the press freedom, you know. I see that the France, which are known as a champion of free speech and of human rights, is now showing a new face. And this face is the face of repression and censorship. So it's a very bad news, not only for the press, but also for the people, as the woman was saying in the demonstration. Because, as you know, we have been a champion, yes, in a freedom of speech and a freedom of press, as we have seen recently with the Mahomet caricature, you know, and the right to blaspheme, as we say in France. So even, you know, what is very strong to understand, that even all the editorial board of the major French channel and the major newspaper, BFM TV, TF1, Le Figaro, Libération, CNews, all the important newspaper and TV channels say that they are against, and they made a publication saying that they are against this Article 24 of the legislation because it will prohibit them, you know, to cover finally the brutality that is going on around France. So we had the law in France. The law is from 1881, which is the law of freedom of speech and freedom of press. And now we are entering, now in 2020, so almost 120 years later, in a new period of censorship and repression and reduction of our liberty.
Okay. We're going to expand on that a little bit more, but Joao Coleman, let me ask you this. I mean, to get down to some of the nitty-gritty of this, it is said that this would limit the right to film or photograph on-duty police officers. Now, looking at that, doesn't that pave the way for officers to commit crimes and break the law while being immune to prosecution?
Of course. Well, yes, of course. I mean, the current restrictions on civil liberties, of course, are technically illegal. We have the right to assembly and the right to walk around and go about our work and about our business without being hassled by police. These are extreme measures which are being imposed not just in France but throughout Europe, and they are part of a transition towards a different type of society. The type of society they want to transition towards is a technocracy. And in a technocracy, the individual has no more civil liberties, and he's under 24-hour surveillance by cameras. We already have cameras everywhere in Europe, in every city. And they fear very much that the people will revolt. The restrictions on restaurants, bars, small businesses that have occurred again in the second lockdown mean that an entire class, essentially the middle class, is now becoming bankrupt. And an entire, the motor of the French economy, the motor of every economy in the world is the middle class, small businesses. They are being destroyed. They fear a social revolt. And of course, they know that if they don't give full powers to the police to repress that using whatever means necessary, the people will film them. And of course, that will go into social media. And so they're also trying to crack down on social media. They want to ban social media effectively and make it impossible for people to open up accounts on social media as well. So we're going into a new period of totalitarian control, essentially. And this is what the lockdowns are about. The lockdowns are completely useless in terms of protecting lives. You only have to look at Sweden to see that it has absolutely no impact on people's health. It's detrimental to people's health, mental and physical. It has nothing to do with public health. It is basically a transition to a new society, and that society is a technocracy. And that's very clear if you look at the global picture, if you look at the plans of Davos and the Great Reset. It's very clear if you read Klaus Schwab's book, for example, his recent book, that the kind of society they want is a society where there would be essentially no more society. It would be a technocracy where everything would be online. Of course, everything would be under surveillance. I mean, this is where we're at right now. So they fear also in France the consequences of the wide diffusion of a documentary recently, which got 6 million views and was seen by many, many people. They fear, you can hear them on the media talking about this all the time, the danger of conspiracy theories, the danger of thinking that there might be a conspiracy behind the lockdown. And of course, they sense that there will be a major social revolt, and probably a lot worse than the recent Gilets Jaunes. So remember, you had a massive rebellion against the state for over a year in France with the Yellow Vest movement that was repressed brutally by the police. And I think that they want to be able to repress the next rebellion with even further measures. So I think that's essentially what this is about.
Well, Sebastian, I'm hearing words like repression, totalitarianism, technocracy, social media restrictions, revolt. I mean, isn't France supposed to be a flag bearer of freedom after all, as the French slogan or motto is liberté, égalité, fraternité, French for liberty, equality, and fraternity? So I'm looking at the word liberty now being downgraded, is because that's what people are talking about, the French, in this respect. Is this the case, that this is being endangered?
It's not in danger if we fight. You know, I'm working with Jacques Cheminade, who was three-time candidate for the presidential election in France, and he has denounced for years, since the 1980s, the imposition of what he called a financial fascism. So it's true that if we want to maintain this financial fascism in the world, because we have to impose austerity, you need dictatorial power. So we have done that in South America. We have done that, I mean, the West have done that in Africa, pushing and putting in place dictatorial power to impose its austerity policy. So now is the turn of Europe. So of course, if we accept because we have to fight for this liberty and we have to fight for this fraternity. If we fight, we can save it. But it's true that if they want to go on with this financial austerity, this financial fascism, they will have to impose more stronger laws, you know, as the one we are seeing today, to control the revolt. Because as the other person mentioned, you know, since 2 years now we have the yellow vest in France, so it's 2 years of demonstration, and from the beginning, you know, the confrontational approach of the government, they decide to have this confrontational approach, I mean repression in the street, was above all to dissuade people and the population to take part at this demonstration. Because at the beginning of the yellow vest, if you remember, we have thousands of people in the street saying, we don't want the privatization of our country, we don't want austerity, we need to have food at the end of the month, so it's not possible anymore. So now we are angry and we want to change the system. So of course you have a revolt against this system, and we are fighting with Jacques Cheminade and Solidarité Progrès, with other countries in the world, fighting to change, to have this new Bretton Woods system, a new financial architecture, because, and it's true, what Emmanuel Barroso was calling the European Union, we know, a non-imperial empire, as he was saying, which is a supranational institution imposing austerity on people. So the people don't want that anymore. They are fighting for that. And I think the question of the documentary was mentioned is quite dangerous, because, of course, half of the documentary is very interesting against the criminal responsibility of the government, but the other half is pushing people, you know, in irrationality and going after, you know, things which are not the real cause of the problem, which is the financial system and this financial oligarchy. So we have to focus, as the Yellow Vest was doing at the beginning, to go back to the monetary sovereignty of our country with a national banking system, with the Glass-Steagall, which means the separation of the bank in France, and of course the possibility to have our own credit system to reinvest in infrastructure, entrepreneurship, development, and so on and so forth. That's the main issue to fight for today.
Okay, well let's zoom in on this word revolt, Gerard Coleman, if we can look at this word and see what's happening. We're looking at a COVID-19 pandemic to have struck, obviously, many parts of the world, Europe no exception, of course, France also. Now, I'm going to ask your reaction to this particular headline, which is very alarming, that came out roughly a week ago. And it said, Europe's governments are losing control of COVID, and because of that, revolt is in the air. And it says that fears of civil unrest are growing as people across the continent no longer trust their leaders to protect them during the crisis. So do you think that maybe the French administration, headed by Macron, is foreseeing something like that perhaps happening? There have been protests in France. We've seen it in Italy, in Naples, where people were just fed up with the lockdowns. And maybe this is a way to make sure that the police is protected, since they are predicting, perhaps, that there's going to be revolts and protests, so we need the police out on the streets. Do you think this may be the case?
Well, they've certainly lost control of the narrative, the COVID-19 narrative. They've lost control of that, I think, because we now have thousands of scientists and doctors speaking out about it. And the consensus they wanted, the absolute consensus about what it is and how dangerous it is and therefore what they need to do, that has broken down. Because of alternative media, because of social media, there's been a massive amount of censorship of science during this entire debate, and we've had a monopoly in the media of people linked to pharmaceutical companies and pharmaceutical interests. And there's a huge pharmaceutical agenda, of course, behind the vaccine, which will make billions of dollars for these big companies. And as your guest said, it is a financial oligarchy after all, and all these companies are linked to finance markets and high finance. So they do fear a rebellion against that. Of course, they won't be able to impose and make obligatory this vaccine, which is a new type of vaccine, extremely dangerous. It hasn't been tested before. They won't be able to impose that very easily. There's a lot of vaccine skepticism in France. And I don't think that in any case, we don't even know what COVID-19 is, because it's never actually been isolated. So you cannot possibly vaccinate against something you don't really understand. And there is no need to vaccinate against it anyway, because it only kills people who are very, very old, and they usually die of other diseases as well. It isn't really killing people in the way they say it is. It's mostly people who have comorbidities. So I think, what people fear, I would say, rather than this, this so-called pandemic, is the measures, the harsh measures that infringe on people's liberty. And, you know, if you fear COVID-19, then by all means wear a mask. If you fear COVID-19, then you should have the possibility of staying in your house forever. Why not? Maybe be able to work from home. But people who don't fear it should be allowed to live it normally, and it should not be prevented from going about their business, and they should not be forced to wear masks and forced to social distance and so on and so forth. And it is these top-down measures, really, which is making life impossible for people. I mean, life has become literally impossible. We now live in a dystopian nightmare. Nothing is open, you're not allowed to do anything, and you're not allowed to say anything. If you have to wear a mask all the time, you can't even have a conversation with people. So this has to stop. You know, this nonsense has to stop. The narrative about COVID-19 is over. It's finished. The so-called pandemic has been over with months. So most of the scientists say, so there is no need to keep this up. But of course, it's not about public health. As I said, the aim of this entire agenda is to move towards a technocracy. And, you know, as Thatcher said, society doesn't exist. Society won't exist in a technocracy. And the family won't exist. Social structures won't exist. Social relations won't exist. And they want people in front of screens and iPhones. They want them connected to the Internet of Things. And it will be the big tech which will decide. And eventually, it will be, you know, people who are savvy in big tech who will be the controllers of society. And, of course, high finance is the overall system we're talking about here.
Okay. When it comes to freedom, however, and rights, Sebastian, you know, the French are known to make their voices heard. They're known for demonstrating. I mean, we've seen the French demonstrate throughout time, and they have demonstrated and they have earned the rights that they have fought for so hard. So, you know, if it comes down to their freedom being restricted, if this is one of the levels that the government is going through that perhaps could lead to other things, other restrictions or oppression, don't you think that you're going to have an outburst of people who are going to come out on the streets? I mean, we've seen it with the Yellow Vests, what they have done. Perhaps we're going to see them again coming out and protesting this law. Do you think that is a possibility?
Of course. It's already, you know, going on. You know, you have demonstration yesterday evening, with a lot of brutality, you know. But from both sides, that's also one of the problems, is that people are becoming violent in both sides, because everybody is angry. The policemen, because they have no money, they are not paid, you know, they have to work 24 hours because you have demonstration all the time, and people who are not have self-sufficient economically. So you have kind of, with the disintegration of our economy by the financial institution, we have a kind of civil war, you know, mass strike ferment in our country, which is very dangerous. So I think, for the lockdown, is not the same issue. Of course, the COVID, we have a lot of mistakes which have been made. You know, for you take Sweden, for example, they are locking people down now because they wanted to not do it at the beginning, so they have to do it now partially. But we cannot say that it's fake news all the time, because if you go in the hospital, what I have done in France, you go to the hospital, people are working 24 hours. You know, at least at the first lockdown, people were working very hard to save life all the time, you know. So the second lockdown was not justified, for sure. But the first one was not a fake news, as we can hear from some scientists. People are really dying. A lot of people have died, not only in France, but in the world. So I think we have to compare what we are saying about this. And I want to say that the problem we have is not this crisis, is the financial disintegration of our system, and with this technocracy, as it was said, to impose financial austerity by all means, with the big pharma, with the GAFAM, with the Silicon Valley, with a mass surveillance system and control of the population. yes, we are all this problem to fight together.
Thank you very much for that. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guests, political analyst and member of Solidarity and Progress Party, Sebastian Perimonida from Paris, and journalist and political analyst, Jehua Coleman from Paris also. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Batakhli, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's public addresses, interviews, and other remarks are characterized by bravado, hate-mongering, big lies, and mass deception. U.S. foreign policy with him at State Department has been one of the darkest chapters in the nation's history. Recently, the CIA-connected Washington Post slammed his legacy of incompetence, adding, "It peaked with his failed Iran policy." His latest moves, visiting an illegal Israeli settlement in occupied Golan Heights, were as mean-spirited as misguided. His intention to further sanction Iran weekly through 20th of January is perfectly consistent with his track record of staging poorly conceived publicity stunts rather than undertaking any actual diplomacy with the government of Iran. He and the Trump administration overall have been all sticks and no carrots geopolitically. We now present you an article written by Stephen Lenman, a Chicago-based research author, research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization, and host of the Progressive Radio News Hour. The piece is titled "Loose Cannon: Pompeo's War of Words on Iran." Please stay with us for more. Words could kill, loose cannon, Mike Pompeo's remarks would be considered weapons of mass destruction. The big lie about an Iranian threat has been around for decades. Ignored is that Washington's only threats are invented, none are real. What's been geopolitically clear since the Second World War ended. In stark contrast, hardliners from both right wings of the U.S. War Party threaten everyone everywhere. U.S. imperial aims, by diabolical means used to advance them, represent an unparalleled threat to humanity. The Islamic Republic of Iran is the region's leading proponent of peace and stability. Its ruling authorities pursue cooperative relations with other countries and confrontation with none. Long-standing U.S. plans for regime change are all about its sovereign independence. Nations free from its imperial control aren't tolerated. In West Asia, they're an obstacle to U.S. and Israeli hegemonic aims. In Iran's case, long-standing U.S. hostility towards the country is also about wanting to control Iran's vast hydrocarbon reserves. The Trump regime hardliners escalated war on Iran by other means, beyond where their predecessors went. My previous article discussed possible U.S. aggression and threats against Iran during what may be Donald Trump's final weeks in office. While he continues inherited hot wars in Afghanistan, Syria, and Yemen, and waged greater wars than ever by other means against targeted countries, he did not initiate new aggression on his watch. With 2 months of his tenure remaining, if legal challenges to brazen election fraud fail, will he go at the 11th hour where he hasn't gone before? Would he risk embroiling West Asia in greater than ever conflict since the Second World War ended, during what may be his final days in office? Would he want to be remembered for launching what could develop into catastrophic war as his parting shot as the US President and Commander-in-Chief? Would he risk more greatly tainting his record in office than already? I believe a Trump regime war on Iran before 20th of January is highly unlikely. At the same time, war of words on the Islamic Republic and piling on more illegal sanctions will continue over the next 2 months and beyond. As long as Iran refuses to subordinate its sovereign rights to US interests, what no nation should do, it will remain a prime target for regime change. That's how the scourge of imperialism works, permitting no nation to remain free from its iron grip. On Monday, 23rd of November, hawkish US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo concluded visits with officials in France, Turkey, Georgia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and occupied Palestine. Before leaving the occupied Palestinian territories, he was interviewed by the Zionist regime's daily The Jerusalem Post. Asked if all Trump administration options remain on the table against Iran, Pompeo claimed, "Of course. The administration has been clear on that for its entire 4 years," he added. "There is no reason that would change that today or tomorrow." Defying reality, he falsely claimed maximum pressure success. President Donald Trump's regime's West Asian policies overall made the US more of a pariah state than already. Iran today is much stronger politically and militarily than when Donald Trump took office, its latter strength solely for defensive purposes. Its geopolitical agenda is polar opposite of how the US operates on the world stage, waging peace and stability in stark contrast to Washington's war on humanity. Mike Pompeo's public addresses, interviews, and other remarks are characterized by bravado, hate-mongering, big lies, and mass deception. U.S. foreign policy with him at the State Department has been one of the darkest chapters in America's history. Recently, the CIA-connected Washington Post slammed his legacy of incompetence, adding, "It peaked with his failed Iran policy. His latest move, visiting an illegal Israeli settlement and the occupied Golan Heights, were as mean-spirited as misguided." His intention to further sanction Iran weekly through to 20th of January is perfectly consistent with his track record of staging poorly perceived publicity stunts rather than undertaking any actual diplomacy with the government of Iran. He said the Trump regime overall has been all sticks and no carrots geopolitically. Its so-called maximum pressure policy only disrupting the import of medicines and food for ordinary Iranians who are fighting the coronavirus pandemic. The Trump regime's maximum pressure policy has been a total bust. Pompeo's interview with Jerusalem Post was characterized by a litany of bold-faced big lies, an absence of hard truths. He lied saying Iran foments regional harm, a US-NATO-Israeli speciality, not how Tehran operates anywhere. claiming Trump regime actions against Iran isolated the country is belied by reality. He lied calling Trump's geopolitical agenda a vision of peace, an anathema notion in Washington. Pompeo lied accusing Iran of being prime actor who is causing instability in West Asia. He is spearheading an effort to try to prevent the United States from returning to the JCPOA if Biden-Harris administration replaces the Trump administration on 20th of January. He reinvented the Trump regime's West Asia agenda, claiming continuation of the things we've been doing leads to a very increased likelihood of a safer, more prosperous region, and that our Israeli friends will be safer and more secure as a result of that as well. Pretending concern for Palestinian rights ignored nearly 4 years of Trump regime's trampling on Palestinian rights. Trump's domestic and geopolitical agendas have been virtually wrecking balls for ordinary people both at home and abroad. They've been a gift that keeps on giving to the wealthy, power and privilege interests at the expense of most people everywhere. Trump will be remembered as a bombastic businessman, geopolitical know-nothing, reality TV president. Mike Pompeo will be remembered as a thug masquerading as a diplomat. The last 4 years will be remembered as one of America's darkest chapters. What's coming will likely be worse domestically and geopolitically, no matter which wing of U.S. geopoly rule controls the White House and or the Congress.
الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3rd, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq. Greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week. Imam's great initiative in naming Unity Week.
The Palestinian cause will continue to thrive, and the Zionist regime will be destroyed. One of the things that they have done is to establish relations with that murderous and criminal usurper, the Zionist regime. These terms truly describe the Zionist regime. It has usurped Palestinian lands, and it has murdered people. Just look how many Palestinians they have killed and what crimes they have committed. And they were happy at and proud of it, and they fabricated reasons for it. They justified it with ridiculous reasons. What I want to say is that many Muslim governments and many true addressees of the message did not unfortunately grasp the significance of Imam's initiative, but the enemy did. He understood how important our late Imam's recommendation to create unity among Islamic denominations and their general orientations, not in their beliefs, as everyone has their own beliefs and opinions, was for the Islamic Ummah.
Your light and love, policy, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to to be stronger.
The enemy understood that unity would undermine his influence in Islamic countries. Because he understood it, he began to devise schemes against it. The enemy implemented plans of action to confront our magnanimous Imam's message of unity. For example, he established centers to produce anti-unity thought. We speak of bringing Islamic denominations close to one another. However, they established certain centers and hired some mercenaries to produce thoughts and ideas against the idea of bringing Islamic denominations close to one another. They demanded that the mercenaries do something to foil Imam's great policy and magnificent and divine measures, centers to produce thoughts. Another thing that they did was to create takfiri groups. It was the enemies of Islam who created that lethal group called Daesh. The Americans have acknowledged this. Of course, we had reliable information, but if we had spoken about it, it might have been doubted.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. To Allah, all praises to Allah.